known devotion to the cause of the oppressed people. Smith's views of Douglas could wax even more effusive. Back in 1848, when the North Star appeared, McCune Smith wrote to Gerrit Smith with special praise. "I love Frederick Douglass for his whole-souled outness. That is the secret of his noble thoughts and far-reaching sympathies. You will be surprised to hear me say that only since his editorial career has he begun to become a colored man. I have read his paper very carefully and find phrase after phrase develop itself as regularly as in one newly born among us." In the introduction to Bondage and Freedom, McCune Smith imposed a great burden on Douglas, declaring the former slave the embodiment of the cause of human equality, leader among the living exemplars of the practicability of the most radical abolitionism. When Smith described Douglass's sacred thirst for liberty and learning, Smith was writing about himself as well. The introduction is not only an intellectual's tribute to another intellectual, but the most formally educated black man of the 19th century, telling the world what it means that a Frederick Douglass exists at all in slaveholding America. Smith took special care to show readers that this autobiography was, in the end, literature. Douglass's techniques, according to Smith, were manifold: memory, logic, wit, sarcasm, invective, pathos, and bold imagery of rare structural beauty, he argued, well up as from a copious fountain, yet each in its proper place, and contributing to form a whole, grand in itself, yet complete in the minutest proportions. Douglass's ability with language, Smith maintained, was not in fashioning mere words of eloquence, but workable, doable words that might forge a revolution in the world. Douglass wrote persuasive prose. In this public use of his personal story as a representative American man, Smith believed that Douglass had written an American book for Americans in the fullest sense of the idea. In other words, what could be more American at this juncture in history than a brilliantly rendered, lyrical, and terrible story of a man's journey through hell from slavery to freedom? Surely, Douglass was moved by his friend's political description of the purpose and power of words doing the work of revolution. Nothing seems to have impressed McCune Smith quite like Douglass's uncanny personal memory, fashioned seamlessly into an abolitionist polemic. As an intellectual and scientist, Smith was stunned at the extensive probing Douglass gave to his own childhood, of how the autobiography provided a model for just when positive and persistent memory begins in the human being. Long before neuroscience, Smith pointed to universal psychological and moral insights, as well as to features distinctive to an American slave experience. Smith admired his friend's rare alliance between passion and intellect as a biographer, his energy of character and sheer will, whether working to be king among caulkers or craving after language as reader and orator. The scientist was deeply intrigued by Douglass's capacity for recollection. According to Smith, it was Douglass's wonderful memory that made his autobiographical writing so powerful. Smith felt moved not by Douglass's mere recall of facts, but by the literary act when the memory of them, facts, went seething through his brain, breeding a fiery indignation at his injured selfhood, then bursting out in story and characters. The Physician's Introduction is one of the early meditations on the art of memory, with a former slave as the subject. Smith knew Douglass well enough to understand how much his younger comrade's persona was now entwined with his identity as a writer. Hence, Smith acknowledged Douglass's descriptive and declamatory powers and his logical force. But above all, the author of Bondage and Freedom, as well as of so many great orations, possessed style. Smith took an excursion on the intellectual puzzle of Douglass's literary style, wondering whether it stemmed from his white ancestry or from his Negro blood. Here he followed Douglass down the romantic but blind lane of his mother's literacy as the source of the writer's skill. But for Douglass's style, Smith should have looked no further than the rhetoric itself, its cadences, diction, word choices, and indeed its storytelling. The rhythms of Douglass's language were oratorical, and they were deeply indebted, consciously or not, to his life of reading and using the King James Bible. As the literary scholar Robert Alter writes, it was the Old Testament prophets who spoke so compellingly to the American situation of the 19th century and gave the essence of style to its best writers. Style, says Alter, is not merely a constellation of aesthetic properties, but the vehicle of a particular vision of reality. Style is not the mere drapery hung on the more important ideology and politics driving the best writing. It is the very lifeblood of any prose that persuades about its politics. The Bible gave texture to American prose, and the King James translation, according to Alter, became the wellspring of eloquence and the national book of the American people. That is where any puzzle about Douglass's source of style should be solved. That style is on display all over Bondage and Freedom. In his brilliant depiction of slaveholders' psychic unease about the evil system they practiced on the Y plantation, we can feel Douglass's cadences even as he names his text. This immense wealth, he wrote, this gilded splendor, this profusion of luxury, this exemption from toil, this life of ease, this sea of plenty. Aye, what of it all? Douglass loved repetition. Then he begins to throw down his warnings of future reckoning. Lurking beneath all their dishes are invisible spirits of evil, ready to feed the self-deluded gormandizers with aches, pains, fierce temper, lumbago, and gout. Their souls cannot rest. To the pampered love of ease, Douglass intones with his trademark contrasts, there is no resting place. What is pleasant today is repulsive tomorrow. What is soft now is hard at another time. What is sweet in the morning is bitter in the evening. Then he simply gives Isaiah and Jeremiah the last word in this oracle about the woe in history's plan for slaveholders. Neither to the wicked nor to the idler is there any solid peace, troubled like the restless sea. Thus, for Douglass, style and argument flowed together in the same torrent of words. All great autobiography is about loss, about the hopeless but necessary quest to retrieve and control a past that forever slips away. Memory is both inspiration and burden, method and subject, the thing one cannot live with or without. Smith grasped just how true this was for a former slave who seized literacy. Douglass's past was a dangerous place to go, but as he returned to it over and over, he made memory into art, brilliantly and mischievously employing its authority, its elusiveness, its truths, and its charms. Douglass's memory was fraught with conflicted images. Sometimes he flattened them out to control his tale of self-made ascension, but other times he just described the brutal contrasts and reached for truth. He often hid as much as he revealed, especially about his family and personal life. But what he did reveal in Bondage and Freedom is one man's deeply personal indictment of the past and present of his country, and a risky, bold vision of a different future. Smith understood the power of such a symbol. He stressed Douglass's essentially American mixed-race identity. Here, Americans could see their future, Smith contended. Douglass was one of the Romuluses and Remuses who are to inaugurate the new birth of our republic. Neither man yet knew the prescience of that claim. Hence, in part via Smith's guidance, we can see the political character of Douglass's second autobiography. If a stranger landed in the United States, Smith maintained, and sought out America's most prominent men from the sheer volume of attention in newspapers and on the telegraphs, he would discover Douglass. During the past winter, 1854-5, very frequent mention of Frederick Douglass was made, said Smith. Douglass had emerged as one of those people to whom others say, "Tell me your thought," and somehow or other, revolution seemed to follow in his wake. Indeed, in 1854, the orator's name started to appear frequently in the press in comparison to the other Douglass, Stephen, senator from Illinois. The New York Tribune published a poem the former slave must have enjoyed. Let slavery now stop her mouth, and quiet be henceforth. We've got Fred Douglass from the South. She's got Steve from the North. The two men nearly encountered each other in Illinois in October that same year. Douglass dogged Douglass as the latter barnstormed, selling the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Once they even rode the same rail car, but the senator feigned illness to avoid a confrontation. On the floor of Congress by 1856, a Democrat and a Republican squared off over the principles of their respective parties. The Republican said his adversaries blindly follow and worship Mr. Douglass. But the Illinois Democrat retorted that while we worship Stephen A. Douglass, the Republicans worship Fred Douglass. Smith grasped Douglass's desperate ambition as well as his genuine fame. Douglass divided bondage and freedom into two sections, life as a slave and life as a freeman. Especially in the second section, but even in the first, in some of his enhanced portrayals of his Maryland origins, he wrote as the political abolitionist. In Bondage and Freedom, Douglass revised many moments in his story to show himself as a young leader among his fellow slaves, even as the potentially violent black rebel. When Thomas Auld and his fellow Methodists broke up Douglass's first effort at a Sabbath school in St. Michael's, using clubs, one of the pious crew, recalled Douglass, told me that as for my part, as leader, I wanted to be another Nat Turner, and if I did not look out, I should get as many balls into me as Nat did into him. In 1845, Douglass wrote that Master Auld found him merely unsuitable due to his urban Baltimore experiences. But by 1855, this changed to the tale of a much more aggressive, rebellious slave, invoking the blood-curdling image of slave rebellion. In the narrative, Douglass gave approximately 11 pages to the story of his travail with Edward Covey, while in 1855 he devoted approximately 32 pages to this pivotal experience in the grip of the tyrant's vice. In 1845, Douglass did not seem to hold back in showing how Covey beat him mercilessly when he had fallen to the ground, weak with sunstroke. His blood ran freely. But in Bondage and Freedom, this episode, which precipitates his delirious flight through the woods to St. Michael's to seek Auld's protection, gets much bloodier still. A half dozen uses of the words blood or bleeding turn in the revision to 15 expressions of the same words in two pages. The language becomes biblical. Douglass's sufferings all but a slow crucifixion. His body is mangled by briars and thorns, his hair clotted with dust and blood, his feet and legs scarred with blood marks. In the end, Auld does not protect him. This would-be Jesus must face near death before he can find redemption. Auld forsakes his wounded slave, saying he deserved the flogging because of laziness. He rejects Frederick's appeal for help with the cowardly and revealing statement that, as a hired hand to Covey, he, Auld as owner, could not lose his slave's wages for the entire year. By 1855, Douglass knew just which biblical story in which to place this moment. He threw the charge of laziness right back at Auld. Slaveholders, he wrote, using Matthew chapter 23, verse 4, bind heavy burdens, grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. The passage comes just before Jesus demands, woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. The much deeper texture of the 1855 work reveals a writer who would now sound the profounder depths of slave life to set up his ultimate disenthrallment. Douglass became a fish in a net allowed to play for a time, but was soon drawn rapidly to the shore. He was now rendered a wild young working animal, not merely learning to drive the oxen, but becoming the oxen. I now saw several points of similarity with that of the oxen. They were property, so was I. They were to be broken, so was I. Covey was to break me. I was to break them. Break and be broken. Such is life. All these metaphors set up the necessity that it is Covey who must be broken in violent resistance. The psychological and physical tyranny portrayed on Covey's farm in Bondage and Freedom is the kind that can only result in not merely individual, but collective revolution. As Douglas got the best of Covey in their barnyard rumble, the desperate slave owner called out to his slave named Caroline, a powerful woman, to come to his aid. But Caroline, who does not appear in the 1845 version of the scene, steadfastly refuses to answer her master's command, leading the autobiographer to wryly conclude, "We were all in open rebellion that morning." Thus, goaded almost to madness and savagely brutalized, Douglas created a vision in which only violence could result, a condition in which he soon argued the entire nation would find itself. In Bondage and Freedom, Douglas still claimed he fought Covey only from a defensive posture, but this time he attacked with a fighting madness and left no doubt that Covey deserved to be bloodied or even killed. This violence was for the good of the slave's own soul, not merely a matter of natural right. "I was a changed being after that fight," said Douglas, the completely recovered Garrisonian. "I was nothing before. I was a man now. It recalled to life my crushed self-respect. A man without force is without the essential dignity of humanity." Similarly, his defense of the escape plot among his fellow slaves on the Freeland farm no longer stood merely as an act of natural right. In Bondage and Freedom, it stemmed from the right of revolutionary violence. The slaveholder, kind or cruel, is every hour silently whetting the knife of vengeance for his own throat, wrote the autobiographer, who was also now the rescuer of the Christiana riot fugitives. A slaveholder never lisps a syllable in commendation of the fathers of this republic without asserting the rights of rebellion for his own slaves. A leitmotif in Bondage and Freedom is an expectation of violence. Examples abound in Bondage and Freedom of Douglas's more assertive, political brand of autobiography. He captures his burgeoning independence from the Garrisonians in a voice that needed new terrain, new horizons. Walt Whitman could have had a former slave like Douglas in mind in Poets to Come. Poets to come, orators, singers, musicians to come. Not today is to justify me and answer what I am for. But you, a new brood, native, athletic, continental, greater than before known, arouse, for you must justify me. We do not know if Whitman ever read Douglas. Whitman would have found a new prose poet, remembering his reading and thinking, the orator who was growing and needed room, now looking steadfastly to speak just the word that seemed to me the word to be spoken by me. "I myself but write one or two indicative words for the future," said Whitman, "but advance a moment only to wheel and hurry back into the darkness." Douglas wrote in 1855 in depth about his past of darkness, so as to chart a much wider future. The reason we remember Douglas is because he found the word. Douglas portrayed his sojourn in the British Isles as in part an education in self-realization and political action. The ways that racial prejudice aboard the Cambria helped him as a stranger to get fairly before the British public read as a primer for his later role as independent editor and activist. The ways Douglas learned to court public scorn, to relish being unpopular and notorious, his defense against the accusation that his speeches attacking America in Britain and upon his return to his native country had been harsh in spirit, read like the preparation of the Jeremiah of 1852. Like the Old Testament prophets, Douglas knew that he had to lay down the story of grievance and suffering, as well as national betrayal, before imagining historical renewal. Bondage and Freedom contained many elements of the prophetic tradition: warnings, destruction, and reinvention. His splendid apostasy against the Garrisonians led him to a radical change in his opinions and a new platform of political action. When describing his last years struggling as a moral suasionist, Douglas said he had performed with pen and tongue. But on the last page of Bondage and Freedom, he announced his new disposition. His book added his story to a long, blood-written history, and clouds full of wrathful thunder and lightning hovered over the land. But Douglas gave a full-throated statement that progress is still possible. Then, in the final sentence of the book, he promised that while heaven lent him ability, he would strive to use my voice, my pen, or my vote. Whether the temple could be destroyed by votes remained to be seen. Douglas spent the decade from 1841 to 1851 trying to denounce voting as a mechanism of black freedom. In the 1850s, however, to secure and cast that vote, along with a recurring struggle with the beast of violence, became the central questions of his public life. Douglas saw slavery as an all-encompassing evil, but also as a threat to national existence, and therefore an immensely political problem. Writing much later in Life and Times, Douglas described his outlook during these crisis years before the Civil War. I confess to a feeling allied dissatisfaction at the prospect of conflict between North and South. Standing outside the pale of American humanity, denied citizenship, unable to call the land of my birth my country, I was ready for any political upheaval which would bring about a change in the existing condition of things. Beneath these remembered yearnings lay the tormented experience of a black abolitionist desperate for political strife that could forge revolutionary change. But in real time, how could a radical with a pen, a voice, and an individual vote ever bring this about? Did he simply await the moral logic and force of history, or did he act to try to force a cataclysm? In the years 1854 to 1857, such an upheaval arrived with the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which potentially opened all Western territory to the expansion of slavery. Moreover, a border vigilante war known as Bleeding Kansas broke out and helped to cause the birth of the Republican Party. Douglas threw himself into this new political fray. He launched new lecture tours with Bondage and Freedom in tow. But the home trials, frequent illnesses, and financial insecurity dogged his life. Having just returned from yet another grueling lecture trip in March 1855, Douglas offered a rare glimpse of his personal moods. His anxiety over the turmoil roiling in the country masked a similar tension in his domestic world in Rochester. He seemed a weary man, reaching out publicly for solace. Words of cheer in a gloomy moment, he said, have an inspiring tendency. They brush away the cloud and let in the sunlight. They cause a smile to nestle in the countenance, once distorted with sorrowful emotions. Was this Douglas's personal cry for help? This is a cold, bleak world, he concluded, but not without its oases. Douglas returned in yet another homecoming to the house out on the edge of Rochester, surrounded by Anna Douglas's ever-enlarging garden. Julia Griffiths still lived with the Porters down the road and labored daily in town at the newspaper office. His five children, all still at home, ranged in age from 6 to 16. Despite the lecture fees and soon the sales of the second memoir, the newspaper was still in dire straits. In the coming year, Douglas was once again beholden to Gerrit Smith's largesse to keep Frederick Douglass's paper alive. I am almost convinced that my paper cannot be sustained, wrote a discouraged Douglas as he told Smith of his $1,500 debt. I have failed, at least for the moment. The prospect is dark. His explanation was that he was not partisan enough, refusing to join up as a Republican Party organ, but also, as he had long complained, the colored people do very little to support it. Douglas was privately desperate as he once again begged for money from his benefactor. I am sick at the thought of the failure of my paper, but when a man cannot stand up, he must fall down. His children were growing up and increasing their demands upon me, Douglas told Smith. He felt a father's humiliation. He whistled positively as he also pled for help. calling himself quite well off, having health and heart, a good house and lot. Bondage and freedom would sell, he hoped, as long as I can lecture. Douglas seemed a man who did not know, once again, quite where to turn. His trusted confidant and co-worker, Griffiths, returned to England in June 1855, her welcome worn out around the Douglas household. Before leaving, in a partly illegible letter to Gerrit Smith, dated September 9th, likely 1854, Julia discussed her plans to return to England. An unnamed leader thought it expedient for me to recross the Atlantic, she remarked, although many others, doubtless, and they weigh greatly with me, seem to indicate this to be my post. I like my occupation exceedingly when I have health and strength to go through my duties to my satisfaction, but that has not been the case of late. Before concluding, Julia left a cryptic Old Testament inspiration. Pharaoh's chariot wheels have dragged heavily. Drawn from Exodus, chapter 14, verse 25, she referred to God opening the waters of the Red Sea for the children of Israel to cross to freedom as Pharaoh's soldiers retreated, their chariot wheels breaking and falling off. Julia would never return to America, despite a claim that her voyage back to England was only a temporary absence. But she would remain a vigorous supporter of Douglas's paper, a loyal correspondent and anti-slavery organizer in Britain, as long as the two lived. Indeed, upon her return to England, she began a series of more than 80 public letters published in Douglas's paper, providing coverage of British anti-slavery as well as a kind of travel diary of a literary Victorian woman. The first of those letters, in a series entitled Letters from the Old World, provided a gem of travel writing, complete with portraiture of people she met, of conversations, and the power and beauty of nature. As her ship sighted land on the return voyage, she beheld the Welsh mountains clothed with verdure and irradiated by the soft sunshine of early morning. However burdened, Douglas could escape into Julia's frequent travelogues, especially when she reached the Scotland he so loved. She was a beautiful, if florid, writer, especially in the land where Walter Scott is echoed everywhere, in every wind that blows, every breeze that sighs, every bird that sings, every flower that blooms. Julia knew how to make her friend miss her. Within a year of Griffiths's departure from Rochester, another white woman stepped into Douglas's life and caused even more private complication, even as she too became an assiduous participant in the reformer's intellectual life. Ottilie Assing, a German-Jewish radical 48er, moved to America to pursue a new career as a journalist in 1852, taking up residence in Hoboken, New Jersey. She traveled, met many reformers, and wrote numerous essays for the German journal Morgenblatt. Well-educated, free-thinking, and non-religious, steeped in the German romantics, she read Bondage and Freedom in 1855 and determined to translate it into German, which she did by 1860, with her own introduction replacing that of McCune Smith. She came to Rochester to meet Douglas in 1856, and for the next 24 years, almost never left. Douglas's relationship with Assing would be tempestuous, to say the least, but oddly with little controversy, except at home. Douglas's marriage was greatly strained in the 1850s. He and Anna rarely shared the same friends, nor an intellectual companionship. The meaning of his life's calling and ambition drew them apart, even as Frederick greatly depended on Anna's skill and devotion as homemaker and mother. Douglas left few open comments about Anna and their marriage, but he did sometimes complain to friends. In 1857, after returning from the speaking circuit, Douglas wrote harshly of his wife, "I am sad to say that she is by no means well, and if I should write down all her complaints, there could be no room to put my name at the bottom, although the world would have it that I am actually at the bottom of it all." Then his anger turned ugly in a comment about Anna's use of language. "She still seems able to use with great ease and fluency her powers of speech, and by the time I am home a week or two longer, I shall have pretty fully learned in how many points there is need of improvement in my temper and disposition as a husband and father, the head of the family. This rare glimpse into Douglas's domestic situation adds meaning to the fear of failure he had expressed to Gerrit Smith. As husband and father, he also had much to ponder. That their marriage survived is a testament not only to the rarity of divorce in the 19th century, but especially to Anna's utter lack of options, and to Douglas's own lifelong craving for a sense of home, about which he wrote so compellingly in Bondage and Freedom. In the mid-1850s, as before, Douglas plowed his private woes into great public activism. He and Anna sustained a home under trying circumstances that for moderns might have driven them apart. In the 1852 political campaign, Douglas established a pattern of shifting party allegiances and endorsements. In that year, he remained ostensibly a member of Gerrit Smith's fledgling Liberty Party, while openly supporting the new Free Soil presidential ticket of John P. Hale and George Julian. The Free Soil Party drew its energy and electoral strategy from the crisis over the Mexican War in the late 1840s and the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. At the Free Soil Convention in Pittsburgh in August, Douglas announced himself proudly a disciple of Gerrit Smith, and especially of the doctrine that any government legally sanctioning slavery was a foul and blasting conspiracy. But from that radical high ground, Douglas stepped down to continually learn that politics and perfectionism did not easily mix. That summer and fall, Douglas all but surrendered the editorship of his paper and allowed Julia Griffiths and his assistant, John Thomas, to take the reins. He went on the road constantly all over New York State and for a 2-week tour of Ohio in September. Douglas felt for the first time politically called to the field, he told his readers. Julia asked subscribers to be patient, since the summons for him, the editor, seems to come simultaneously from almost every county in the state of New York. Wherever the train lines or a carriage could carry him, Douglas stumped for the Free Democracy, Free Soilers, and against both the Whig and Democratic parties. He delivered some 15 lectures in and around Dryden and McGrawville, New York. On October 1st, he announced appearances in at least 11 towns in Tompkins County alone. The schedule was backbreaking, but on an earlier stop in Ithaca in late July, Douglas described a little break before the evening speech. He hiked a mile or two along the east bank of Cayuga Lake until he found a suitable place to renew my acquaintance with the art of swimming. He told of his sheer joy in a kind of diary for the paper. Here, all my boyish pranks in the front basin of Baltimore were renewed. I had a glorious swim. On his Ohio tour, which included a convention in Salem, Douglas was Jim Crowed twice. Going west on a boat on Lake Erie between Buffalo and Cleveland, the captain forced him to sleep on wood planks on the deck. On the return eastward, a captain assaulted Douglas at a dinner table. He pulled the chair from under us and brought us down upon the cabin floor, wrote the traveler. In Buffalo, Douglas consulted a lawyer, only to be told that the law was clearly on his side, but that no local judge would convict someone in such a case. There is something canine in the bark and growl of a genuine Negro hater, concluded the weary traveler, who could still smile. But a truce to puppies. He loved his Ohio audiences of abolitionists. He felt inspired by the throngs composed mainly of hard-handed farmers, their industrious wives, daughters, and sisters. Back home in New York, surging in and out of small towns and villages, Douglas spoke twice a day, he said, for a week in Oneida and Herkimer counties. In mid-October, he spoke in 10 towns in 7 days, and at the end of the campaign, he reported a total of 80 lectures in some 40 days on the road. Everywhere Douglas went, he denounced the Fugitive Slave Act, argued that slavery could never be legal, demanded his auditors enter the civic and political fray, and acknowledged that the characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin danced in the heads of voters in this season of politics. Abolitionist principles, he believed, had never had such a political airing as now. At a speech in Ithaca in October, he boiled down his decade-long career to a personal statement of his politics. I have one great political idea. That idea is an old one, widely and generally assented to, nevertheless, generally trampled upon and disregarded. The best expressions of his views, he said, were found in the Bible. From Proverbs, he declared, "Righteousness exalteth a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people." Such a moral declaration, he concluded, constitutes the whole of my politics. Such a choice of scripture is interesting for a recovering moral suasionist. In all the maxims about wisdom and folly in Proverbs, though, Douglas would also have read many passages about how the prudent gain knowledge and understanding, and the deceitful fall in folly. His politics was anything but settled. Like his sense of abolitionist strategy, it grew into a mixture of righteousness and pragmatism. In his paper, Douglas delivered a ringing endorsement of Hale and the Free Soilers, despite that Hale had refused to declare slavery a form of piracy, as demanded by the Liberty Party. The bulk of Douglas's endorsement reveals a mind torn between moral principle and political action. He urged liberty men to remember that a vote could seldom represent all of one's moral convictions. Sounding like a veteran politician, he offered a rule for action. The voter ought to see to it that his vote shall secure the highest good possible, at the same time that it does no harm. Once converted to political abolitionism, Douglas characteristically gave it his heart, mind, and soul, but he demanded more of it than it could deliver. Demonstrating his political fickleness just before the November 1852 elections, Douglas withdrew his support of the Free Soilers and instead rejoiced in Gerrit Smith's election to the U.S. Congress. Within a year and a half, everything seemed to change. Douglas's initial reaction to the Kansas-Nebraska Act in early 1854 was a combination of outrage and refurbished hope. In his view, the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, the geographical guarantee against slavery north of the 36 degrees 30 minutes parallel, resulted from the villainy of the slave power and the pusillanimity of the North. The Republic swings clear from all her ancient moorings, he rejoiced, from the isolation of Rochester, and moves off upon a tempestuous and perilous sea. Woe, woe, woe to slavery. Her mightiest shield is broken, and for one, we now say, let the battle come. He felt encouraged by the increasing severity of the various drafts of the Kansas-Nebraska Bill. If we must have the repeal of the Missouri restriction, Douglas wrote privately, let nothing be done to soften the measure. With good reason, he anticipated a political awakening in the North, a rise in anti-slavery sentiment, and the splintering of political parties along sectional lines. Here was the anticipated political upheaval beyond anyone's control. Let the old parties go to destruction, Douglas gleefully urged, and henceforth let there be only a free party and a slave party. A whole new front of attack seemed now to have opened, the ironic result of the slave power's insatiable quests for dominion. The social furor and the rapid political realignment that gave birth to the Republican Party in 1854 provided the kind of revolutionary circumstance Douglas sought. He exploited every opportunity to expose the growing hostility between North and South, employing the concept of irrepressible conflict considerably before the Republican William H. Seward made it famous in 1858. Douglas strove not to assuage fears of the impending crisis, but to hasten its coming. By 1855, he proclaimed, "The hour which shall witness the final struggle is on the wing. Already we hear the booming of the bell which shall yet toll the death knell of human slavery." As the old prophets had foretold for their own decadent and lost age, a vengeful and just God, and Douglas would add, natural law, made this American conflict a certainty. His message was, people, get ready. As a nation, Douglas exhorted, if we are wise, we will prepare for the last conflict in which the enemy of freedom must capitulate. His fondest hope was that the new politics would bring an age of truth and error, liberty and slavery, in a hand-to-hand conflict. In the old stories, Douglas told his readers they would find the vision to end all compromises. He performed in editorials as a prophet with an ultimate duty of hope. The disintegration of the once powerful political parties, he announced, is a cheering and significant sign of the times. The throne of the despot is trembling to its deep foundations. There is a good time coming. The imprecision of such rhetoric required at least a clarified enemy. The abstract evil of slavery was never sufficient. But in the concept of the slave power, Douglas found a means to convert the enemy of black people into the enemy of all Americans. The idea of a slave power conspiracy was at least as old as the 1820s. But in the 1850s, it became the staple of anti-slavery rhetoric. Douglas had plied these waters before the Republicans made it their own. In May 1853, he gave the slave power clear definition. It was a purely slavery party in national affairs, and its branches reached far and wide in church and state. The conspiracy's chief objectives were suppression of abolitionist speech, removal of free blacks from the United States, guarantees for slavery in the West, the nationalization of slavery in every state of the Union, and the expansion of slavery to Mexico and South America. If not stopped, the slave power would drive the Almighty from the councils of the nation as it shot its leprous distillment through the lifeblood of the people. Slavery was no longer merely a moral wrong committed against black people in the South, but a widening threat to the liberties of white people. One end of the slave's chain must be fastened to a padlock in the lips of northern freemen, Douglas wrote, else the slave will himself become free. Here, now, was an enemy of all mankind. Everything was at stake. Slavery aims at absolute sway, Douglas argued in 1854. It would drive out the schoolmaster and install the slave driver, burn the schoolhouse and install the whipping post, prohibit the Holy Bible and establish the bloody slave code, dishonor free labor with its hope of reward, and establish slave labor with its dread of the lash. This evil heart of the political system had to be surrounded, stopped, and killed. By 1855, as the Kansas crisis deepened, Douglas saw the slave power as an all-encompassing national plague with a natural craving after human flesh and blood. It was an onslaught upon the rights of all Americans to sustain the claims of a few. Most poignantly, the slave power delivered its Decalogue of Slavery, written all over the country, in its highways and its hedges, its villages and towns and cities. It had to expend every energy in expanding the area of despotism to feed its survival. Citizen Douglas, imagining the unknown revolution to come, demanded war upon this monster. Show the enemy no quarter, he pleaded. Annihilation, not restriction. This is the motto to be inscribed upon our banners. Off with his head, and his heart will cease to beat forever. He put prudence aside. The politics of fear exploded from the pages of the radical journalist in Rochester. Like several other abolitionists, Douglas later became a kind of historian of the slave power, devoting an entire chapter, The Increasing Demands of the Slave Power, to the topic in his 1881 autobiography, Life and Times. Searching for a central theme of the 1850s, Douglas honored his fellow abolitionists, but gave greater credit to the aggressive character of slavery itself. In Douglas's telling, anti-slavery agitators merely reaped the political results of the slaveocracy's innate aggression to dominate the nation's future. In Life and Times, he quoted the long section of his 1853 New York speech, in which he analyzed the character of the slave power. He chose an excerpt probing the slaveholder's anxious obsession with security. But again, he summoned Isaiah to his aid. There can be no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. Even if every anti-slavery tongue were silent, every anti-slavery organization dissolved, Douglas said, still, the slaveholder could have no peace. In 1881, as in the 1850s, Douglas still needed to declare God, nature, history, and psychology on the side of abolition. In every pulsation of his, the slaveholder's, heart, in every throb of his life, in every glance of his eye, would still be waked an accuser whose cause is, "Thou art verily guilty concerning thy brother." As the accuser, Douglas found a new arena in politics. But the struggle demanded a new kind of will and persuasion. Douglas wanted the controversy to cause Americans to look inward and not simply to the West or to Washington. Confrontation with the slave power, the editor hoped, would force an even deeper confrontation with race. Black humanity, or whether blacks had rights exceeding those of a horse, Douglas claimed in 1856, formed the grand hinge of American politics. He did not want the slave power frenzy at election time to deflect attention from a deeper enemy, racism itself. He remained on guard against the tendency in anti-slavery politics of opposing slavery but hating its victims. Hence, Douglas's bitter chastisements of Horace Greeley on the issue of black suffrage. The famed editor of the New York Tribune advised blacks to lie low, be patient about the right to vote, and concentrate rather on their own moral debasement. They should stop jawing about their rights, Greeley wrote, with what Douglas called condescension. Such counsel of patience appalled Douglas, and he fought back, insisting upon complete equality at the polls, vowing never to keep out of sight, and invoking Byron, "They who would be free themselves must strike the blow." Greeley's comments remained useful as a recruiting device. To draw blacks to a national convention in the fall of 1855, Douglas said, "The eye of the world is upon us." Urged to keep out of sight, he wryly announced, "Our counselors should be aware that black bodies appear to better advantage in the sunlight." As Douglas made the slave power rhetoric his own, he also worried about the potential for compromise. Seeking consensus with the slave power, Douglas maintained, would be thawing a deadly viper instead of killing it. A radical pragmatist had many fences to straddle now. All he could do was to keep faith in the monster's inherent tendency to overreach and destroy itself. Coining a new label in 1855, Douglas called the slaveocracy the Black Power, arguing that it would go the way of all absolute despotisms. "While crushing its millions," he said, "it is also crushing itself." It had made such a frightful noise with the Fugitive Slave Act, the Nebraska Bill, the recent marauding movements of the oligarchy in Kansas, that it now performed as the abolitionists' most potent ally. Douglas detected a great change in Northern public opinion. Instead of regarding the abolitionists as mere fanatics crying wolf, the masses now perceived the evil in their midst, and themselves cried, "Kill the wolf." More than from any other single issue before the war, Douglas derived his sense of political pragmatism from coming to grips with the Republican Party, the odd assemblage of former Whigs, anti-slavery Democrats, Liberty Party men, and even nativists, who all coalesced around stopping the expansion of slavery. His reactions ranged from vehement opposition to cautious support. Two contradictory themes run through all of Douglas's rhetoric regarding the Republicans. He demanded adherence to abolitionist principles. The free soil position, therefore, offered him little immediate satisfaction, even as it provided hope of thwarting slavery's future. But simultaneously, he found it impossible to resist the appeal of a broad coalition that could discredit slavery. From 1854 to the Civil War, Douglas found much to attack in Republican ideology. At times, he condemned free soilism and the slave power with almost the same ire. Free soilism is lame, halt, and blind, wrote Douglass in 1855, while it battles against the spread of slavery and admits its right to exist anywhere. His editorials occasionally burned with bitterness over the non-extension argument. Drawing a boundary around slavery, though a departure, seemed so limited to one who had grown up on immediatism. Instead of walking straight up to the giant wrong and demanding its utter overthrow, he complained, we are talking of limiting it, circumscribing it, surrounding it with free states, and leaving it to die of inward decay. To Douglass, in 1855-56, the Republican vision seemed a hollow promise, leaving millions doomed to bondage. By the presidential election year of 1856, Douglass refused to formally join the Republican Party and tried to steadfastly adhere to abolitionist principles. The Republicans, he asserted in April, possessed not a single warm and living position, except freedom in Kansas, and represented only a sinuous political philosophy, which is the grand corrupter of all reforms. As the title of an editorial indicated, Douglass intended to do his duty as an anti-slavery voter. That duty meant emphasis on the sin of slavery and the impossibility of property in man. It meant, at least at this juncture, the preservation of his anti-slavery integrity. But another potent force drew Douglass to the duty of hope, to the agonizing awareness that slavery had to be met in the shadowlands of politics. Douglass's denunciations of the Kansas-Nebraska Act led almost inevitably to tacit support of the emerging Republican Party, formed in the law's turbulent wake. The Kansas controversy had become the great question of the age, he said by fall 1854, and it prompted him to devise his own strangely naive scheme for making Kansas a free state. Douglass proposed an ambitious emigration plan by which 1,000 free black families from northern cities would be resettled in Kansas territory. His army of 1,000 families was to be organized and financed by northern philanthropy. But fervor is about all Douglass could give his own idea. The true antidote for black slaves, he argued, is an enlightened body of black freemen. Suddenly, Douglass was an impractical emigrationist dreamer. Douglass's plan conveniently ignored for an interlude that the free labor ideology around which Republicans had formed meant for many free white labor. Douglass soon abandoned what he admitted was an imperfectly presented scheme. From such a combination of confusion, idealism, and frustration, Douglass approached the election of 1856. The purity and high anti-slavery ground he had demanded in the spring gave way slowly over the summer. He continued to proclaim himself a devotee of Gerrit Smith and his New Radical Abolition Party, which pushed the doctrine that the federal government had the duty to abolish slavery everywhere. In a June 1856 endorsement of the Radical Party, he kept faith with his mentor that policy is controlled by principle and not principle by policy. Using a strict anti-slavery conception of the Constitution, Douglass stayed on high ground. Whatever is right is practicable. But by August, Douglass did an about-face, shocking some of his friends, and enthusiastically endorsed for president the Republican John C. Fremont, famous Western explorer and former California senator. Suddenly, Douglass preached expediency like an old ward boss. His heart and judgment still clung to Gerrit Smith's principles, he insisted, like ivy to the oak. But the time has passed, Douglass now believed, for an honest man to attempt any defense of a right to change his opinion as to political methods of opposing slavery. He justified his flip-flop by claiming a desire to affect power by any means possible. Anti-slavery consistency itself requires of the anti-slavery voter that disposition of his vote, which in all the circumstances tends most to the triumph of free principles. Right anti-slavery action is that which deals the deadliest blow upon slavery that can be given at that particular time. Such action is always consistent, however different may be the forms through which it expresses itself. He thus offered a capacious definition to political pragmatism. Douglas further defended his turnabout by arguing that he would do his best to uphold the radical abolition platform within the ranks of the Republicans. Moreover, all the depredations of the slave power demanded a forceful response. He wanted abolition politics to be the aggressor at the ballot box, instead of always on the fringe. With slavery extension, Douglas argued, slaveholders had given abolitionists an invitation to battle, and he understood just how much Republicans, with their capacity to win high offices, threatened the South. Douglas urged his radical friends to take them, Republicans, not merely for what they are, but for what we have good reason to believe they will become. Republicans were millions strong, while radical abolitionists operated like dwellers in the mountain peaks of the moral world. Douglas urged a vote for Fremont as the path to do a possible good thing, while larger aims could wait. Stop seeking purity, he told his critics among radicals, and start with what is possible. The Ethiopian can change his opinion, he wrote during the fall campaign, if not his color, and yet be perfectly true to the great cause of his life. Douglas's 1856 endorsement of the Republican Party conformed to a pattern he had established in 1848 and 1852, when he supported the Free Soil Party. In the Liberty Party and its doctrinal successor, the Radical Abolitionists, Douglas always had a party for his principles. But in the Republicans, as with the Free Soilers before, he found a party for his hopes. In late August 1856, he wrote to Gerrit Smith, hoping his mentor would understand if not approve. I support Fremont as the best thing I can do now, but without losing sight of the great doctrines and measures inseparable from your great name and character. It would hardly be the last time Douglas cast his vote for hope in general elections, then in off-year contests retreated to his principles among the radicals. By the fall of 1857, in the wake of Fremont's defeat by James Buchanan, Douglas changed his tune markedly about the Republicans, charging them with culpable imbecility and narrow, contracted conservatism. Because it had not embraced any form of black equality and sought only power in numbers, the Republican Party had become rotten, Douglas maintained, and did not deserve success. But for the rest of his life, Douglas voted for a Republican for president. Fremont did extremely well against the Democrat James Buchanan, known widely as a Northern man with Southern sympathies. Although defeated, the Republicans, as a sectional anti-slavery party, loomed as a powerful threat to Southern interests, despite their not even being on the ballot in most slave states. Buchanan was elected with only 45% of the vote, while Fremont drew 33%, and the Know-Nothing Party nativist candidate, Millard Fillmore, garnered 21%. The election settled little in the slavery crisis, except that the slave power, in the view of most anti-slavery Northerners, now had a willing advocate in the White House, and the Republicans had the potential to divide American politics. Within 2 days of Buchanan's inauguration, in March 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court announced the Dred Scott decision, and once again, everything seemed to change. Dred Scott's legal quest for his freedom, because of a near 5-year residence on the free soil of the state of Illinois and the free territory of Minnesota, had wound its way through lower courts for years in Missouri, and finally reached the docket of the Supreme Court in 1854. Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, a Marylander and former slave owner, and his 7-2 majority on the court first ruled on jurisdiction, declaring Scott not a citizen due to his race, and therefore without any right to sue in federal court. Under pressure to somehow settle the vexing problem of slavery expansion once and for all, Taney and his majority went further and declared the Missouri Compromise line of 1820 unconstitutional. They upheld a slaveholder's right to use and transport his private property in slaves under the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Congressional authority over slave property, said Taney resoundingly, extended only to